This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Billion Dollar Whale, The Man Who Fooled Wall Street, Hollywood, and the World. Written by Tom Wright and Bradley Hope. Read by Will Collier. Includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of bonus material. Dedication to Mum, Nina, Julia, and Lawrence, T.W. To Farah, Jumana, and Sufiyan, B.H. Author's note. In 2015, we began reporting on a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund after rumors began swirling about its towering debts and shadowy dealings. It was an intriguing story. Goldman Sachs had made unfathomably large profits helping the fund raise money, and the ensuing scandal over the fate of the cash threatened to topple Malaysia's prime minister. But this was no run-of-the-mill corruption case in yet another developing country. Media reports, and sources we began speaking to, suggested that Joe Low, a little-known 27-year-old associate of the prime minister, had himself taken the money. Possibly hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and used it to build a Hollywood production company, commission one of the world's grandest yachts, and throw wildly decadent parties around the globe. If true, the Low affair would represent one of the greatest financial heists in history. Who was Joe Low? And how did he emerge from obscurity to become the alleged mastermind of a multi-billion dollar scam? One seemingly pulled off under the noses of the financial world. We set out to uncover Low's true identity, and what we found was astonishing. Behind the plain outward appearance and mild manners of Low was a serial fabulist who figured out how the world really works. He was everyone's friend, but few truly knew him beyond his reputation as one of the greatest spenders of money the jet-setting class had seen in a generation. It was not just a wild story involving Wall Street bankers, celebrities, and a silver-tongued con man. Low's very success, at its core, was rooted in the failures of the 21st century global economy. His ability to take so much, fooling Wall Street banks, auditors, and regulators. His success in using untold wealth to buy his way into friendships with the world's most famous actors and models. And the ease with which he made everyone believe he belonged. In all of this, Low was the product of a society preoccupied with wealth and glamour. We realized the amazing life of Joe Low was too incredible to fit neatly into the pages of the Wall Street Journal. By writing a book, we hoped to show in detail how Low did it, but also what drove him, and how he got away with it for so long. That larger portrait, about capitalism and inequality, told through the life of Low, would be of enduring value, we agreed. The material in this audiobook is the result of 3 years of research. We interviewed more than 100 individuals in more than a dozen countries, from the tiny city of Willemstad on the island of Curaçao to Shanghai in China. The majority of people named in the book agreed to talk to us either directly or through legal representation, although a small number declined. Many of our sources insisted on anonymity for fear of physical or legal harm. Every anecdote is based on the recollection of multiple sources, and in some cases backed up by photographs, videos, and other documentation. We have reviewed tens of thousands of documents, including public court records and confidential investigative documents and financial records, as well as hundreds of thousands of emails provided to authorities during the course of investigating the case. We also relied on the official allegations contained in the Justice Department's civil asset forfeiture cases, as well as court proceedings in Singapore and official reports by Swiss authorities. As of this writing, in May 2018, no public charges of criminal wrongdoing have been filed against Joe Low, or most of the major characters in the book. To date, only a handful of bankers in Singapore have served jail time. As we conclude work on the book, The Justice Department is in the throes of a massive criminal investigation into Zhou Lo and others at the center of the case. Authorities in Switzerland and Singapore continue to investigate. All the principal characters in this book have denied committing crimes and maintained the transactions were legal, but they have declined to provide any thorough explanation for their dealings. Zhou Lo, in particular, emphasizes that he has never been charged with any criminal activity in any jurisdiction and that there have been no findings of fact by any court regarding any criminal wrongdoing. Other figures readers will get to know, including Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obaid of a Swiss oil company called Petro Saudi International, and Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak, have maintained, via lawyers, that they did nothing wrong. Any errors are our own. Steal a little, and they throw you in jail. Steal a lot, and they make you king. Bob Dylan, Sweetheart Like You. You get so deep into things sometimes that the abnormal seems normal, and normal seems like a distant memory. Jordan Belfort. Cast of characters. The Lo family. Lo Tech Zhou. Zhou Lo. Lo Tech Zen. Sen Lo, his older brother. Lo Mei Lin, his older sister. Go Gaik Yu, his mother. Lo Hawk Peng, Larry Lo, his father. Jeslin Chuan Tae Ying, Zhou Lo's girlfriend. Lo's associates. Jasmine Lu I Swan, legal counsel at One Malaysia Development, or 1MDB, a Malaysian state investment fund. Casey Tang Kang Chi, 1MDB's executive director. Seat Lee Lin, Wharton friend and vice president of Jinwell Capital, Lo's Hong Kong firm. Eric Tan, Fat Eric, party boy and Lo associate. Nick Faisal Arif Kamil, 1MDB's investment director. Hamad Awazan, Kuwaiti friend. Malaysia. Najib Razak, Malaysia's prime minister. Rosma Mansour, Najib's wife. Riza Aziz, Rosma's son by an earlier marriage, co-founder of Red Granite Pictures. Mahathir Mohamad, former prime minister and Najib nemesis. Anwar Ibrahim, opposition leader. Goldman Sachs. Timothy Leisner, chairman, Southeast Asia. Andrea Vella, head of Goldman's structured finance business in Asia, later co-head of investment banking, Asia. Lloyd Blankfein, chief executive. Gary Cohn, president. Petro Saudi International. Prince Turki bin Abdullah Al Saud, co-founder. Tarek Obaid, co-founder and chief executive officer. Nawaf Obaid, Tarek's brother. Patrick Mahoney, chief investment officer. Xavier Justo, head of London office. Abu Dhabi. Kadem Al-Kubaisi, Managing Director, IPIC. Youssef Al-Oteiba, UAE Ambassador to the United States. Mohammed Badawi Al-Husseini, Chief Executive, Abar Investments. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al-Nayan, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al-Nayan, brother of Sheikh Mohammed and Chairman of IPIC. Khaldun Khalifa Al-Mubarak, Chief Executive of Mubadala Development. BSI. Hans-Peter Brunner, Chief Executive, Asia. Yok Yu Chi, Chief Relationship Banker for Zhou Lo and 1MDB. Yo Jia Wei, a wealth management banker who leaves to work for Zhou Lo. Kevin Swampile, Head of Wealth Management. AmBank. Chia Tech Kwong, Chief Executive. Joanna Yu, banker handling Prime Minister Najib Razak's accounts. Falcon Bank, Eduardo Lehman, Chief Executive. Hollywood/Entertainment. Joey McFarland, friend of Lowe's, co-founder of Red Granite Pictures. Paris Hilton, socialite. Leonardo DiCaprio, actor. Jamie Foxx, actor, musician. Kasim Dean, Swizz Beatz, husband of Alicia Keys, music producer. Busta Rhymes, musician. Noah Tepperberg and Jason Strauss, owners of the strategic hospitality group Nightclub Empire. Miranda Kerr, model. Prakasral Samuel Michel, Praz, musician. Kate Upton, model. Martin Scorsese, director. Elva Hsiao, Taiwanese musician and sometime low girlfriend. Nicole Scherzinger, musician. Journalists. Claire Rucastle Brown, founder of Sarawak Report. Tong Kuyong, owner of The Edge. Ho K. Tat, publisher of The Edge. Federal Bureau of Investigation. William Bill McMurray, head of International Corruption Squad, New York. Robert Hoechling, lead FBI agent on the 1MDB case. Justin McNair, FBI agent and forensic accountant on the case. Prologue. Las Vegas, November 3rd and 4th, 2012. Around 6 p.m. on a warm, cloudless November night, Praz Michel, a former member of the 90s hip-hop trio The Fugees, approached one of the chairman's suites on the fifth floor of the Palazzo Hotel. Praz knocked, and the door opened, revealing a rotund man dressed in a black tuxedo who flashed a warm smile. The man, glowing slightly with perspiration, was known to his friends as Joe Lowe, and he spoke in the soft-voiced lilt common to Malaysians. "Here's my boy," Lowe said, embracing the rapper. The chairman suites, at $25,000 per night, were the most opulent the Palazzo had to offer, with a pool terrace overlooking the strip and a modern white interior, including a karaoke room with wraparound sofas and padded walls. But the host didn't plan to spend much time in the room tonight. Lowe had a much grander celebration in store for his 31st birthday. This was just the pre-party for his inner circle, who had jetted in from across the globe. Guzzling champagne, the guests, an eclectic mix of celebrities and hangers-on, buzzed around Lowe as more people arrived. Swizz Beatz, the hip-hop producer and husband of Alicia Keys, conversed animatedly with Lowe. At one point, Leonardo DiCaprio arrived alongside Benicio del Toro to talk to Lowe about some film ideas. What did the guests make of their host? To many at the gathering, Lowe cut a mysterious figure. Hailing from Malaysia, a small Southeast Asian country that many Westerners would struggle to pinpoint on a map, Lowe's round face was still boyish, with glasses, red cheeks, and barely a hint of facial hair. His unremarkable appearance was matched by an awkwardness and lack of ease in conversation, which the beautiful women around Lowe took to be shyness. Polite and courteous, he never seemed fully in the moment, often cutting short a conversation to take a call on one of his half a dozen cell phones. But despite Lowe's unassuming appearance, word was that he was loaded, maybe a billionaire. Guests murmured to each other that just months earlier, Lowe's company had acquired a stake in EMI Music Publishing, and there was speculation that he was the money behind DiCaprio's latest movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, which was still filming. Lowe's bashful manners belied a hard core of ambition, the like of which the world rarely sees. Look more closely, and Lowe was not so much timid as quietly calculating, as if computing every human interaction, sizing up what he could provide for someone and what they, in turn, could do for him. Despite his age, Lowe had a weird gravitas, allowing him to hold his own in a room of grizzled Wall Street bankers or pampered Hollywood types. For years, he'd methodically cultivated the wealthiest and most powerful people on the planet. The bold strategy had placed him in their orbit and landed him a seat here in the Palazzo. Now, he was the one doling out favors. The night at the Palazzo marked the apex of Lowe's ascendancy. The guest list for his birthday included Hollywood stars, top bankers from Goldman Sachs, and powerful figures from the Middle East. In the aftermath of the U.S. financial crisis, they all wanted a piece of Lowe. Pras Michel had lost his place in the limelight since the Fugees disbanded, but was hoping to reinvent himself as a private equity investor, and Lowe held out the promise of funding. Some celebrities had received hundreds of thousands of dollars in appearance fees from Lowe just to turn up at his events, and they were keen to keep him happy. Swizz Beatz called for quiet in the hotel suite before presenting expensive DJ equipment emblazoned with images of a panda to Lowe as a gift. The group burst into laughter. That was what Lowe's closest friends called him, Panda. A nod to his plump frame and cuddly demeanor. He'd loved Kung Fu Panda, and when gambling with his close friends from back home, they'd each pretend to be a character from the film. But even those stars like Pras and Swizz Beatz, who had received multiple millions of dollars in appearance fees and other business deals from Lowe, could not really claim to know his story. If you entered Joe Lowe into Google, very little came up. Some people said he was an Asian arms dealer. Others claimed he was close to the Prime Minister of Malaysia. Or maybe he inherited billions from his Chinese grandfather. Casino operators and nightclubs refer to their highest rollers as whales. And one thing was certain about Lowe. He was the most extravagant whale that Vegas, New York, and Saint-Tropez had seen in a long time. Maybe ever. A few hours later, just after 9 p.m., Lowe's guests began the journey to the evening's main event. To avoid the paparazzi, they strode through staff-only areas, including a kitchen, before emerging into a concrete tunnel leading to the hotel's parking garage. A fleet of black limousines stood ready, engines purring. This was a special arrangement the Palazzo permitted for only its most lucrative guests. Every move felt seamlessly scripted, doors opening at the right moment, and young, smiling women gesturing the way. As the limousines drove up the strip, it was clear they weren't heading to the desert, as some guests thought. Instead, pulling up at what looked like a giant aircraft hangar, specially constructed on a vacant parcel of land. Even the VIPs were in the dark. The cars sailed through security checkpoints before stopping at a red carpet entrance, manned by burly security personnel in black suits, and the first of scores of young models wearing red dresses, some of whom handed out drinks and food, while others, in the crude language of nightclubs, acted as ambient decorations. This was how the super VIPs arrived. But most of the 300 or so guests, some clutching bright red invitations with everyday birthday stylishly rendered in gold lettering, checked in earlier at Lavo nightclub in the Palazzo or at a security post. There, they signed non-disclosure agreements, binding them to secrecy, and handed in their phones, before getting into minibuses for the short distance to the venue. Among them was Robin Leach, who for decades, as host of the TV show Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, had chronicled the spending of rappers, Hollywood stars, and old money dynasties. But that was the 1980s and 1990s, and nothing had prepared him for the intemperance of the night. A gossip columnist for the Las Vegas Sun, Leach, was among the few guests who had gleaned some details of what was coming.
Wicked Whispers exclusive. Britney Spears flying into Vegas tomorrow for secret concert. Biggest Big Bucks private party ever thrown, he tweeted.
One puzzling requirement of Leach's invitation was that he could write about the party, but not name the host. He'd made his career from the desire of rich people to brag about their affluence. What made this guy want to spend so much cash in secret, he wondered. A nightlife veteran, Leach was stunned by the audacity of the construction on the site. As he surveyed the arch of the party venue, which was ample enough to house a Ferris wheel, carousel, circus trampoline, cigar lounge, and plush white couches scattered throughout, he did some calculations. One side was circus-themed, with the other half transformed into an ultra-chic nightclub. With the lighting and devices that sent explosions of fire into the air periodically, it felt like a major concert, not a private event. It must have cost millions, Leach estimated. Here were new lovers Kanye West and Kim Kardashian canoodling under a canopy. Paris Hilton and heartthrob River Viperi whispering by a bar. Actors Bradley Cooper and Zach Galifianakis, on a break from filming The Hangover Part 3, laughed as they took in the scene. It was rare to get so many top actors and musicians together at a single event outside of a big awards show.
We're used to extravagant parties in Las Vegas, but this was the ultimate party, Leach said. I've never been to one like it.
As the guests chatted, Cirque du Soleil-type entertainers walked among them on stilts, while acrobats in lingerie swung on hoops overhead. There were several monster trucks parked on the fringes, and a troop of about 20 little people dressed as Oompa Loompas beating a path through the revelers. In a cordoned-off VIP area, Lowe held court with DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, who was directing The Wolf of Wall Street. As the night wore on, other guests came by, including Robert De Niro, Tobey Maguire, and Olympic gold medalist Michael Phelps. Not every guest that night was a celebrity. Lowe was careful not to overlook his less well-known friends and key business contacts. Among them were Tim Leisner, a German-born banker who was a star dealmaker for Goldman Sachs in Asia, and Mohammed Al-Husseini, the CEO of one of Abu Dhabi's richest investment funds. There were whispers among Wall Street bankers about the huge profits Goldman had been making in Malaysia, hundreds of millions of dollars arranging bonds for a state investment fund. But they hadn't reached insular Hollywood. Lowe's usual entourage was on hand as well, including Fat Eric, whom the Malaysian had gotten to know from the nightclub world in Malaysia, his cousin Howie, and older brother Sen. Waitresses handed out mini bottles of champagne with straws. Bartenders, standing behind the 24-foot ice bar, doled out top-shelf liquor and flutes of cristal. The crowd was already lively when Jamie Foxx started off the show with a video projected on huge screens. It appeared as if friends from around the world had volunteered to help make a surprise birthday video for their good friend Lowe, each dancing a bit of the hit song Gangnam Style. Investment bankers from Lowe's Hong Kong-based investment company performed in a conference room. Al-Husseini danced on a jet ski off Abu Dhabi. In truth, the video was partly Lowe's idea, and like every aspect of the evening, from the color of the flowers to the drinks at the bar, it had been carefully orchestrated at his direction. Although the clips came as little surprise to him, Lowe was beaming. As the video ended, Psy, the South Korean singer who had shot to stardom that year for Gangnam Style, played the song live as the crowd erupted. Over the following hour and a half, there were performances from Redfoo and the Party Rock Crew, Busta Rhymes, Q-Tip, Pharrell, and Swizz Beatz, with Ludacris and Chris Brown, who debuted the song Everyday Birthday. During Q-Tip's session, a drunk DiCaprio got on stage and rapped alongside him. Then a giant faux wedding cake was wheeled on stage. After a few moments, Britney Spears, wearing a skimpy, gold-colored outfit, burst out and, joined by dancers, serenaded Lowe with Happy Birthday, as a troop of women began doling out slices of real chocolate cake. Each of the performers earned a fat check, with Spears reportedly taking a six-figure sum for her brief cameo. Then the gifts. The nightlife impresarios who helped set up the party, Noah Tepperberg and Jason Strauss, stopped the music and took a microphone. Lowe had spent tens of millions of dollars in their clubs, Marquee, Tao, and Lavo, over the past few years, just as the financial crisis hit and Wall Street high rollers were feeling the pinch. He was their number one client, and they did everything to ensure other nightclub owners didn't steal him away. As Tepperberg and Strauss motioned to staff, a bright red Lamborghini was driven out into the middle of the marquee. Someone gave not one, but three high-end Ducati motorcycles. Finally, a ribbon-wrapped $2.5 million Bugatti Veyron was presented by Sen Lo to his brother. Even the low-end presents were elaborate. A former talent booker whom Lo had helped transform into a big movie producer, Joey McFarland, presented Lo with a custom wine box with an image of Kung Fu Panda from the animated film, and the words Vintage 1981 and Product of Malaysia engraved in wood. It came with a $1,000 bottle of 1981 Petrus wine, made the year of Lo's birth. Just after 12:20 a.m., the sky lit up with fireworks. Partying went into the early hours, with performances by Usher, DJ Chucky, and Kanye West. Surrounded by celebrities and friends, Lo piled into a limousine and brought the party back to the palazzo, where he gambled well into the bright light of Sunday afternoon. This was the world built by Joe Lo. "While you were sleeping, one Chinese billionaire was having the party of the year," began an article on the website of local radio station KROQ 2 days later, mistaking Lo's nationality. It referred to him as J-Lo. It wasn't the first time Lo's name seeped into the tabloids or was associated with extravagance. And it wasn't the last. But the Vegas birthday party was a peak moment in his strange and eventful life. Many of those who came across Lo wrote him off as a big-talking scion of a rich Asian family, a spoiled princeling from the booming region and economy of crazy rich Asians. Few people asked questions about him, and those who bothered to do so discovered only fragments of the real person. But Lo wasn't the child of wealth, at least not the kind that would finance a celebrity-studded party. His money came from a series of events that are so unlikely they appear made up. Even today, the scale of what he achieved, the global heists he pulled off, allowing him to pay for that night's party and much, much more, is hard to fathom. Lo might have hailed from Malaysia, but his was a 21st century global scheme. His conspirators came from the world's wealthiest 0.1%, the richest of the rich, or people who aspired to enter its ranks. Young Americans, Europeans, and Asians who studied for MBAs together, took jobs in finance, and partied in New York, Las Vegas, London, Cannes, and Hong Kong. The backdrop was the global financial crisis, which had sent the U.S. economy plummeting into recession, adding to the allure of a spendthrift Asian billionaire like Lo. Armed with more liquid cash than possibly any individual in history, Lo infiltrated the very heart of U.S. power. He was enabled by his obscure origins and the fact that people had only a vague notion of Malaysia. If he claimed to be a Malaysian prince, then it was true. The heir to a billion-dollar fortune? Sure, it might be right, but nobody seemed to care. Not Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, who were promised tens of millions of dollars to make films. Not Paris Hilton, Jamie Foxx, and other stars who were paid handsomely to appear at events. Not Jason Strauss and Noah Tepperberg, whose nightclub empire was thriving. Not the supermodels on whom Lo lavished multi-million dollar jewelry. Not the Wall Street bankers, who made tens of millions of dollars in bonuses. And certainly not Lo's protector, Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. Lo's scheme involved the purchase of storied companies, friendships with the world's most celebrated people, trysts with extraordinarily beautiful women, and even a visit to the White House. Most of all, it involved an extraordinary and complex manipulation of global finance. As of this writing, the FBI is still attempting to unravel exactly what occurred. Billions of dollars in Malaysian government money, raised with the help of Goldman Sachs, has disappeared into a Byzantine labyrinth of bank accounts, offshore companies, and other complex financial structures. As the scheme began to crash down around them, Malaysia's prime minister turned his back on democracy in an attempt to cling onto power. Wanted for questioning by the FBI, Low disappeared into thin air. Joe Low's story epitomizes the shocking power of those who learn how to master the levers of international finance in the 21st century. How he thrived, and what it says about the failure of global capitalism, is the subject of this book. The story begins on the palm-fringed island of Penang. Part 1. The Invention of Joe Low. Chapter 1. Fake Photos. Penang, Malaysia, summer 1999. As he moved around the Lady Orient, a 160-foot yacht docked at a government marina on Penang Island, Joe Low periodically checked he wasn't being observed. Stashed in his pocket were a handful of photographs of his family. His father, Larry Low, a businessman who had made millions of dollars through his stake in a local garment manufacturer. His mother, Go Gaik Yu, a proud housewife who doted on her children. And his two elder siblings. Locating photos of the boat's owner, a Penang-based billionaire, he eased the snapshots one by one from their frames, replacing them with those of his own family. Later, he did the same at a British colonial-era holiday home on Penang Hill, which he also had borrowed from the billionaire, a friend of Low's family. From Penang Hill, covered in rainforest, Low could see down to Georgetown, the British colonial capital named for George III, a warren of whitewashed mansions and crumbling Chinese shophouses. Beyond, the narrow straits that separated Penang Island from continental Asia came into view. Situated at the mouth of the Strait of Malacca, an important sea lane linking Europe and the Middle East to China, Penang had attracted its share of adventurers, from British colonial officers to Chinese traders and other assorted carpetbaggers. The streets bustled with Penangites, mainly Chinese Malaysians, who loved eating out at the many street-side stalls or walking along the seaside promenade. Low's grandfather washed up in Penang in the 1960s from China, by way of Thailand, and his family had built a small fortune. They were a wealthy clan by any standard, but Low recently had begun attending Harrow, the elite boarding school in England, where some of his classmates counted their family's wealth in billions, not mere millions. Larry's shares in the garment company, which he recently had sold, were worth around $15 million, a huge sum in the Southeast Asian nation, where many people lived on $1,000 per month. But Low had begun to mix with members of the royal families of Brunei and Kuwait at Harrow, where he had arrived in 1998 for the last 2 years of high school. The Low home, a palm tree-fringed modernist mansion on the north coast of Penang, was impressive and had its own central cooling system, but it was no royal palace. In a few days, some of Low's new school pals would be arriving. He had convinced them to spend part of their summer vacation in Malaysia, and he was eager to impress. Just as his father had raised the family's station in Penang, earning enough to send his son to one of the world's most expensive boarding schools, so Low harbored ambitions. He was somewhat embarrassed by the backwater of Penang, and he used the boat and holiday home to compensate. His Harrow friends were none the wiser. With his pudgy frame and glasses, Low never found it easy to attract women, so he clamored to be respected in other ways. He told his Harrow friends he was a Prince of Malaysia, an attempt to keep up with the blue bloods around him. In reality, the ethnic Chinese of the nation, like the Lows, were not the aristocrats, but traders who came later to the country in big waves during the 19th and 20th centuries. The majority of Malaysia's 30 million people were Muslim Malays, who typically treated the Chinese as newcomers, even if their families had lived in Malaysia for generations. Some of the older Chinese in Penang began to wonder about this strange kid. After Lo's Harrow friends had come and gone, the story of the photos began to circulate around the island, as did Lo's claims to an aristocratic lineage. People laughed over the sheer chutzpah. Who did this kid think he was? In the 1960s, Penang Island was a ramshackle place. The British granted independence in 1957 to its colony of Malaya, a tropical Southeast Asian territory rich in tin and palm oil, after fighting an inconclusive and sapping war against a communist insurgency. From their jungle redoubts near the Thai border, communist rebels bided their time, and soon would start a years-long guerrilla war against the untested forces of the newly established nation of Malaysia. This lawless frontier region was an area that Meng Tak, Lo's grandfather, knew well. He'd left his native Guangdong province in China in the 1940s, a time of great upheaval due to the Second World War, Japanese occupation, and a civil war that led millions to flee the country, and settled in southern Thailand, near Malaya. He made some money as a minor investor in an iron ore mine, and married a local woman of Chinese ancestry, before moving on again to Penang in the 1960s. The Lo family lived in a modest bungalow in Georgetown, the capital of Penang, just a few blocks back from the peeling British-era colonnaded villas and warehouses on the palm-fringed shoreline. Many Chinese had emigrated here during colonial times to trade in commodities like tin and opium, a narcotic whose sale the British had monopolized, but which now was illegal. There were dark rumors in Georgetown's close-knit community about the origin of Meng Tak's money. Some old-timers remembered him running a cookware shop in the city. But perhaps the story about iron ore mining in Thailand was only part of the truth. Others whispered that he'd made money smuggling opium over the border. For each version of the Lo family's history, there was an alternate recounting. Decades later, Lo started telling his own story about Meng Tak, one he fabricated to explain how he was in possession of enormous wealth. The money, he told anyone who would listen, came from his grandfather's investments in mining, liquor trading, and property. There was only one problem. Few in Malaysia, neither top bankers nor business leaders, had ever heard of this fabulously rich family. With Lo's father, Larry, the family story comes into sharper focus. Born in Thailand in 1952, Larry Lo moved as a young child to Penang and went on to study at the London School of Economics and the University of California, Los Angeles, for an MBA. On returning to Malaysia, he took over Meng Tak's business. Despite his elite school, Larry made a disastrous investment in the 1980s in cocoa plantations that almost wiped out the family wealth. After commodity prices dropped, he used what was left to buy a minority stake in a company that produced clothes for export to the United States and Europe. This time, Larry hit the jackpot. The 1990s were anything-goes years for Malaysia's nascent stock market. Asian tiger economies like South Korea and Taiwan had taken off from the 1960s, and now it was the turn of other Asian nations. Malaysia's economy was growing at over 5% annually, powered by the export of commodities like palm oil, as well as garments, computer chips, and electronic devices. Attracted by the hot growth, foreign investors poured money into Malaysian stocks and bonds. But there was no oversight. Insiders regularly traded on insider information or colluded to move prices, as if taking their cues from the excesses of 1980s figures such as Michael Milken, the U.S. junk bond king, and insider trader Ivan Boesky. Malaysians who knew how to play the system became incredibly rich, while minority shareholders lost out. People who worked with Larry considered him charming and a wheeler dealer, albeit with a lazy streak, preferring drinking late in nightclubs to work. But he benefited nevertheless from a run-up in the garment company's stock. In the early 1990s, he was involved in an acquisition by MWE, the garment company in which he owned a minority stake, of a Canadian technology firm. The deal overvalued the target firm, and Larry arranged for some of the excess cash to go into an offshore bank account he controlled. Using such accounts, often owned by anonymous shell companies set up in places like the British Virgin Islands, was common for Malaysian companies at the time. The younger Lowes learned from their father about this world of secret finance, and Mei Lin, Lowes' sister, became a lawyer with an expertise in offshore vehicles. When he uncovered that Larry had funneled off the money, the owner of MWE was furious, and not long after, Larry sold his stake in the company. But there was a silver lining. The increase in MWE's stock price in the 1990s had made the Lowe family millionaires many times over. Flush with cash, Larry, now in his 40s, indulged his desire to party. For one celebration on a yacht, he arranged for Swedish models to fly into Penang, the kind of arrangement for which his son later would be known. The family was a big fish in a small pond, and acting the part. Larry drove around town in a Lexus, and was a member of the Penang Club, an exclusive sports club founded by the British in 1868, and whose members included well-known business families and politicians from the island. The younger Lowe was a keen swimmer, often doing laps on Sundays in the pool by the ocean before eating a Chinese dinner with his family. But Larry saw all this as parochial, and he had ambitions to raise his family's social standing. So in 1994, when Lowe was 13, his father moved him out of the local education system to Uplands, an international school that rich Penangites chose to prepare their children for boarding school in Britain. Many elite Malaysians had gotten their education in the former colonial power, and it was still the country of choice for overseas schooling. Larry Lowe opted to put down roots in England. Around this time, developers of a new gated community in London's posh South Kensington neighborhood began to advertise in Malaysia. Some of the most powerful Malaysian politicians owned homes in the Kensington Green development, and Larry sensed it could only be beneficial for an ambitious family like the Lowes to develop friendships with these people. He bought an apartment in the complex, and the family began to vacation there, which gave Lowe the opportunity to meet the children of Malaysia's elite. Larry's alertness to status seemed to rub off on his sons, who began to forge a friendship with Riza Aziz, a college student whose family also had a place in Kensington Green. Riza's stepfather was Defense Minister Najib Razak, who was tipped as a future prime minister. A few years older, Riza would be the key to Lowe's entry into the upper echelons of Malaysia's power structure. Back home, in Penang, Larry ordered a beautiful cream-colored mansion built on a hill outside Georgetown, which, with its sleek steel and glass look, could have been plucked from the streets of Miami. The modern edifice was a step up from the somewhat modest family house that Meng Tak had constructed. As Larry acquired the trappings of an upper-class life, the teenage Joe Lowe was busying himself exploring the nascent online world. Lowe took to spending hours at his computer, hiding behind the anonymity of the web. He began to fib in an offhand way, offering himself on an online chat site for modeling in any part of the world. On the forum, Lowe described himself as muscular, well-proportioned, but received no modeling offers. A class photo from 1994 shows Lowe as a slight middle school student dressed in a white short-sleeved shirt and blue shorts, with a neat but unstylish haircut. His online activities suggested a longing to be cool. He asked people on chat rooms what hardcore techno music they suggested, or which haircuts were popular in different countries. Although he vacationed in England, Lowe appeared more pulled toward American culture, as was typical among younger Malaysians. One of his favorite shows was The X-Files, and he traded photos of Mulder and Scully with other fans online. Since selling out of MWE, Larry had begun to dabble in property investment and stock trading. And Lowe showed an interest in this world. He devoured Hollywood films like Wall Street, with its tale of insider trading and corporate raiding. And at Uplands, he pooled resources with fellow students to invest in the stock market, even though he was only 15 years old. Many adults remember Lowe as smooth and deferential, but adept at using this charm to get what he wanted. On occasion, he would borrow small sums of money from Larry's friends, many of them wealthy businessmen, and then not pay them back. Larry was plotting the next phase of the family's rise. He had the apartment in London and the Swish mansion in Penang. Lowe's elder brother, Sen, had studied at Sevenoaks, a prestigious school in England. Now, he was about to send his youngest son to one of the world's premier boarding schools. It was a decision that would catapult Lowe into the exclusive club of the world's richest people. For decades, Harrow, situated on a bucolic hill in the northwest of London, had churned out British prime ministers such as Sir Winston Churchill. But by the late 1990s, it was attracting new money from Asia and the Middle East. For wealthy Malaysians, Harrow in the late 1990s had a reputation as easier to get into than Eton, another of Britain's top boarding schools, but still an effective way to grease entry into Oxford or Cambridge and to make contacts. To reduce costs, Malaysians often would attend only the final 2 years of high school to prepare for A-level exams. And that was exactly what Larry chose for his son. In 1998, 16-year-old Joe Lowe arrived at Harrow, some of whose buildings date to the 1600s. In Penang, the Uplands uniform consisted of short-sleeved shirts and slacks. At Harrow, pupils were required to don navy blazers and ties, topped with a cream-colored boater hat. The fees were high, more than $20,000 each year. But for the Lowes, it was an investment worth making. At Harrow, Lowe thrived as a member of Newlands, one of the school's 12 houses of 70 or so pupils. Newlands pupils, which had included members of the Rothschild family, the Anglo-French banking dynasty, lived in a four-story red brick detached building from the 1800s, much like the townhouse of a well-to-do Victorian-era businessman. Although Lowe was relatively wealthy himself, he quickly fell in with a new group of friends from Middle Eastern and Asian royal families, and was struck by the cash at their disposal. These were people, including the son of the Sultan of Brunei, a small, oil-rich country abutting Malaysia, who were picked up by drivers in Rolls-Royce cars at the end of term. Surrounded by his elite new friends, Lowe began to display a more risk-taking side to his personality. He sneaked into Harrow's library with a group of students who had a mini roulette wheel and played for small amounts of money. On another occasion, he procured the letterhead of the Brunei embassy from his friend and forged a letter to China White, the famous nightclub near Piccadilly Circus that in the 1990s was one of the city's hottest spots. In the letter, supposedly from staff at the embassy, Lowe asked for tables to be reserved at China White for members of Brunei's royal family. The gambit worked, and Lowe and his underage friends went partying alongside Premier League soccer players and models. It was a lesson that power and prestige, or at least the appearance of it, opened all kinds of doors. Lowe positioned himself in the group as someone who could get things done. He'd make the bookings and collect money when it came time for the bill, making it appear like he was the one paying. He became the fixer, trading off his proximity to the truly powerful, and it had the effect of making him a focus of attention. On vacations, Lowe headed to the Kensington Green apartment, where he spent more time with Riza Aziz. He knew that Malaysian politicians, like Riza's stepfather, paid only moderate official government salaries, could never afford to live in multi-million pound homes in London's toniest district. Everyone was aware that Malaysia's ruling party, the United Malays National Organization, demanded kickbacks from businesses for granting everything from gambling licenses to infrastructure contracts. Many of those businesses were controlled by Chinese Malaysians, like the Lowe's. The situation stirred in him a moral relativism. If everyone was taking a cut, then what was the problem? After Harrow, Lowe opted to attend college in the United States. He had business ambitions, and America was his choice over stuffy Oxford and Cambridge. There, on the campus of an Ivy League school, he would enter the next stage of his metamorphosis. Chapter 2. Asian Great Gatsby. Philadelphia, November 2001. Lowe stood in the nightclub he'd rented for his 20th birthday, Shampoo, one of Philadelphia's most popular, and surveyed his domain. He'd agreed to pay around $40,000 for a full bar and canapes, and to keep out regular guests, giving the club an air of exclusivity. Only in his sophomore year, Lowe had spent weeks flicking through the student directory at the University of Pennsylvania. He had cold-called the social chairs of sororities to ensure the club was crammed with sought-after women. This wasn't a normal student night of beer pong, and everyone turned up, from the jocks to the artsy crowd and the foreign students. The bar was stocked with champagne in sufficient supply to keep everyone's glass brimming all night. Tipsy and swaying self-consciously to the pounding music under a gigantic disco ball, Lowe made awkward small talk with the women, asking them if they were enjoying the party. He seemed extremely anxious to please. At one point during the evening, a model wearing only a bikini made of lettuce leaves walked across the dance floor and reclined on a bar top. The waiting staff covered her near-naked body in sushi for the guests to eat with chopsticks. Lowe looked on at the spectacle, smiling as the crowd roared with laughter. Among themselves, some partygoers that night referred to Lowe as the Asian Great Gatsby, a reflection of how their host seemed to observe his own parties rather than partake in them. Like Jay Gatsby's, Lowe's origins were shrouded in mystery. The guests felt the need to talk to their benefactor, but conversations were stilted and trailed off. He was friendly enough, but really didn't have anything interesting to say, instead preferring to repeatedly ensure his guests were sated. "Do you like the champagne? How's the sushi?" He wasn't hitting on women in the way other male students did when they hosted parties. In fact, he wasn't even flirting. Lowe chose the university's business-focused Wharton School, whose alumni included Warren Buffett and Donald Trump, for its reputation as a production line for top financiers. For $25,000 a year, students in the economics department, where Lowe was studying, learned the mechanics of capitalism. Many of his classmates, wealthy students from across the globe, envisioned a career on Wall Street. Lowe majored in finance rather than dry macroeconomics, but he wasn't planning on a regular banking career. The Malaysian worked hard in his first year. He was a quick study with a prodigious memory, but he began to see Wharton foremost as a place to socialize and build his contacts. That night in Shampoo, like the many others he would organize over the ensuing 15 years in nightclubs and casinos across the world, was pure performance, orchestrated by Lowe to impress. For sure, he enjoyed partying, and he liked having pretty women around. But more than anything, this was an investment, one that made him appear successful and indispensable. That was why, ahead of the night in Shampoo, he had made an ostentatious request. The flyers for the party should have Joe Lowe emblazoned in big letters next to those of the sororities. Lowe handed out two types of invites, standard and VIP, promising a complimentary premium open bar, and with details of shuttle buses from campus to the club. He intuitively understood that people desire to feel important, part of an exclusive club, and he played on it. "Fashionable attire is a must," No jeans or sneakers, the invites read. Sure, Lo was rich, with a family wealth in the millions. While at Wharton, he would receive regular wire transfers of tens of thousands of dollars from Larry Lo to finance gambling trips to Atlantic City and to pay for partying. The money was a gift from a wealthy, doting father, ensuring Lo made a name for himself with the children of influential families who attended Wharton. But even with his father's backing, Lo was stretched to afford the cost of the night at Shampoo. Unknown to his guests, he had put down only a portion of the costs up front, and later stalled on paying the balance to the club's owners, haggling for months before finally settling on a steep discount. Lo began to invite sorority members and his Asian and Middle Eastern friends to gamble, hiring stretch limos for the one-hour drive to Atlantic City. The group often gambled at the Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino, wagering a few $100 a hand. Lo even wrote Ivanka Trump, then a student at Wharton, inviting her to attend. Lo told his friends she declined the offer on the grounds she would never set foot in one of her father's skeevy casinos. The group returned to Atlantic City several times, and Lo at one point was up some $200,000, but he lost all of the gains during one heady night of gambling in 2002. Those around him were shocked at the cavalier attitude he exhibited while betting the equivalent of a year's tuition. This guy, they thought, must have money to burn. The Malaysian worked in other ways to build his brand. He wrote articles on stocks for the Wharton Journal, the business school's student newspaper. One of Lo's pieces, in the November 6, 2000 issue, argued Enron was no longer a conservative gas pipeline firm, but a profitable financial company that had made new markets in commodities. It was only a year before Enron collapsed amid an accounting scandal, sending its top executives to jail. But it wasn't just that the analysis was faulty. Many bankers had fallen for Enron's lies. Lo had plagiarized entire sections of his piece, word for word, from a Solomon Smith Barney report. He wrote many more such pieces, copying most of them from analyst reports on Wall Street. Somehow, this got past editors at the paper, and Lo began to develop a reputation as a stock picker, despite being only a freshman with zero experience analyzing companies. He began to foster an aura of a rich prodigy. On campus, he drove around in a maroon-red SC430 Lexus convertible, which he had leased but passed off as his own. He deliberately didn't correct rumors that he was a prince of Malaysia, a claim that made the other Malaysian students laugh when they heard it. Lo was playing a part, and it was not just to overcome any insecurity about his provincial background, but was aimed at getting him into the right social circle. He identified the wealthiest students and pursued friendships with them. He got to know Hamad Al-Wazan, the son of a Kuwaiti construction and energy magnate, and he befriended students from the rich Gulf states of the Middle East. Alongside this social striver, there was another Lo, one whose friends were from humbler origins, and with whom he'd spend time in the dorm room eating buckets of KFC fried chicken and watching pirated DVD movies from Malaysia. This group included Seet Lee Lin, a whip-smart Singaporean who was on a government scholarship at Wharton. With Seet and their group, Lo would drop the act. They watched boxing on cable, Lo lounging around in a baggy tracksuit, and would spend the odd evening at a Philly strip club called Delilah's or at one of the jock bars on campus. At one point, Lo dated an exotic dancer from the club, whom he lavished with gifts. He fantasized about blonde stars like Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, and watched Hilton's debut film, House of Wax, half a dozen times, spurring eye rolls from roommates. With his soft way of talking, almost inaudible at times, it was easy to forget you were doing what Lo desired. In 2003, he persuaded his Arab friends to help him set up a tour around the Middle East, introducing him to the richest families and most influential firms. Taking a semester off, Lo went to Kuwait, where Al-Wazan arranged meetings with business people and minor royals. Then, in Abu Dhabi, in one of these meetings, enabled by his years of cash-fueled networking, Lo made a connection that would change the course of his life. Chapter 3. Win tons of money. Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, Fall 2003. In a seafood restaurant,